Greetings and welcome to another episode of Soundography, a special edition of Soundography called You Gotta Listen to This, and we'll explain what that means in just a moment. I'm one of your hosts, I'm Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And with us today, we have a very special guest. She's a singer, songwriter, musician, internet streamer, music nerd just like me and Hammond. And without any further ado, Miss Christy Cates.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me on. I love the show. I actually listen to the show quite a bit, and I'm very honored to be on. So thank you very much for having me.
It's actually kind of your fault you were on. You're like, hey, I want to be a guest sometime.
I know. Well, I thought, you know, you don't get anything. Squeaky wheel needs the grease, and I'm
That's
squeaky.
Right. Tall poppy syndrome. Well, and you were kind of the impetus for figuring out this new style of episode we're going to do. So Soundography, the regular episodes, don't worry. Those are still happening. Those are happening just like they've always happened. We're in the process of recording season 3. So they're coming. Please just be patient for Pete's sake. But we are doing these little interim shows to kind of get people ready for season 3 and give them something a little bit different. We're calling it You Gotta Listen to This. And this is where we invite friends of ours on Soundography to talk about albums that they love. Talk about the album song by song and put it in some cultural context. What was going on at the time and where are they now? What's the band doing? Are they still together? Are they still friends? Do they still like each other? We find all that stuff out. But it's a chance for us to bring our friends of the show on, fellow podcasters and other people of that ilk, to make us listen to something that we maybe wouldn't necessarily have listened to otherwise. And Christy, tell us the album that you made us listen to.
I asked you to listen to, asked you politely, Coldplay's Parachutes. It's Coldplay's first album.
That's right. Yes, the big debut. And now, personally, I already had this album. I'm a fan, so I'm glad you made this choice. This is you're going to get some good perspectives here from, I think, fans of three different levels or people. People with Coldplay experience of three different levels. Hammond, how about you? Is this your first listening to the album as a whole?
Yes, you've heard. It was my first listening as a whole. I was familiar with about two or three of their songs from the album. I am familiar with other songs of theirs, sure. But this is the first time I've listened to this one from back to front.
You've seen them on Super Bowls?
Yes, I've seen them on Super Bowls.
Well, on a Super Bowl.
The halftime famous.
Yeah, that's right. And I can probably guess the songs you were familiar with, at least a couple of them.
Well, there's that one song that was on every trailer that came out in 2006, whatever Big Fish was. every trailer used that one song. Was it Clocks or something?
Well,
it's not from this album, but
a lot of them did use the Clocks. Like the beginning goes,
this album though.
I know that. I understand that. That was really the extent of most of my Coldplay experience was like passing over them in the radio and passing over them in trailers and passing over them because I have an opinion. I will save it. It's not a bad opinion. It's just what I think of when I hear them. And I will share that as we get into it.
Cool.
Alrighty.
No, I'm looking forward to that. So yes, the album is Parachutes by Coldplay. Came out in 2000, mid 2000, I think July was the actual release. Was this an album that you picked up immediately? Had you heard their music before, Christy, or what?
Well, no. I mean, this is actually their debut full-length album. They had an EP before this called The Blue Room that I'd heard of, but I hadn't really heard anything of it. And when Parachutes came out is at a time when I was starting to do a lot more songwriting. I mean, I've been playing music since I was, I started playing guitar when I was 12. Actually started writing songs shortly thereafter. Not very good ones, but I started writing songs around that time too. So, you know, once this album came out, it just something about it drew me to it because there's a real mix of like some, there's a lot of, I know it gets kind of ripped on for being a simple album, and there's a lot of beauty for me in simplicity. I think if you can write a very simple melody that resonates with people and it's elegant and it's beautiful, you know, that's part of what drew me to it in the first place. The positivity of a lot of the songs, the way he was very personal with a lot of the songs. And then secondarily, this album led me to not only more of Coldplay's music, but also made me dig further into other bands that I was thinking about at the time, like Radiohead. After hearing Parachutes, I dug further back into Radiohead because that influenced Coldplay. You know, I got led to Travis. I got led into Snow Patrol, Jeff Buckley. So it was almost kind of like this Parachutes album not only stood alone on its own for me as what I thought was a brilliant album, it was also kind of a door into a lot of other music. So it's kind of a nostalgic thing for me as well. So there's a couple different reasons why I like it that much.
That's cool. Yeah. The roots for this kind of grow deep, and not just the roots of the actual band members, but yeah, the influences that they had. And
exactly.
Totally. And you know, you mentioned Travis, great comparison there, great connections there. The very similar style to them. And Jeff Buckley, I never made the connection, but yeah, there is a very,
the vocals,
style.
Singing style, definitely. That's where he gets a lot of his singing influence from, was Jeff Buckley and also Tom York from Radiohead. So it's a kind of a conglomeration of things that ended up influencing me as I was, you know, started writing more songs. So yeah, it means a lot to me. I think it's a great album.
Is this, as the debut, is this your favorite of the Coldplay albums?
You know, that was tough too, because I remember, I think I gave Hammond a tough time. You have to pick one album. And I'm like, I don't want one. I want like 12 albums. He's like, you can't do that. And I'm like, well, can I have two? And he's like, no. And I thought, well, fine. And I'll just make a disclaimer. This is one of my favorite albums.
Rules are rules, okay?
Well, I know. In doing this, pretty clever, Christy, because in doing the first Coldplay album, it gives you the chance to talk about all of Coldplay's albums.
See? There we go. I'm good for the next future of soundography for the next 10 years. So
that's right. Yes, exactly. All right, let's get into the track by track on this.
Before we do that, let me say this. Mm-hmm. Shiver, Yellow, Trouble, and Don't Panic were all released as singles. Mm-hmm. The album did go quickly went to number one in the UK and was certified 8 times platinum. In the U.S., it peaked at number 51 and was certified 2 times platinum. It won the Grammy for Best Alternative Music Album, and to this point has sold around 8.5 million copies.
Wow.
So some people like it, see?
Yeah, for sure.
No accounting for taste.
And it's actually not the biggest Coldplay. Well, no, you wouldn't expect it to be the biggest Coldplay album. Rush of Blood to the Head and X and Y are just slightly ahead of it in copies sold. 2.5 million copies for this as of 2012, and then Rush of Blood to the Head is 2.8, X and Y is at 2.6 million. So, but seriously, all kind of close together. So, I mean, if that's a testament to Coldplay fans being dedicated Coldplay fans, and if you like one, you pick them all up, as opposed to, I picked up one, that's the only Coldplay I really need.
I think, too, that, I mean, just as an aside, that I think they evolve a lot, too, through their albums. If you look at Viva La Vida, it's practically like not quite a rock opera, but, I mean, there's a huge mm-hmm. storyline threading all the way through that and a lot of different influences. Then you go to something like, you know, Milo's Iloto. I can never pronounce that one. And that's, you know, it's almost like an electronica album. So, right. I mean, with all those kind of electronic influences. So I really like how they do evolve and change, but they keep the thread of those really elegant, pretty melodies through everything they do. So it's kind of like the common, you know, common ground there.
A definitely recurring theme on soundography is whether a band should stick to the sound that they came out with and the tried and true accepted sound that got them fans, or if they should continuously evolve. And we've talked about, like, U2 is one of those bands that reinvents themselves on every album. Madonna did that. Mm-hmm. And I think Coldplay does that as well. And I think it is to their success that they do constantly evolve like that.
As someone who doesn't listen to a lot of Coldplay, is it a significant evolution from album to album, or is it incremental evolution?
I feel like it wasn't at first, and then later it was. I think at first it was just kind of like a little bit of growth, and then as they got bigger and, you know, had more resources and kind of got their own recording studio, they could experiment more. And I think the later albums get more complex and pull in a lot more influences.
Also, that shows a lot of trust. That also shows a lot of trust that the label has in them too, that they can play around more.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. And very similar to U2, their first several albums, kind of in that long slope. And I'm not going to keep comparing them to U2. I think that there are some parallels you can draw between the two bands, but by and large, they're very different bands. But in that similar delivery of the first few albums, and then kind of the big jumps from things like Octung Baby to Zooropa and things like that. There were some huge changes for U2 in the same way that there are for Coldplay.
I agree. A lot of similar guitar work too. Like, I think that Johnny Buckland's mm-hmm. really influenced by the Edge. So Yeah.
Could be, yeah. All right. All right. Well, now, Hammond, can I go track by track now?
Yes, you can. I really don't panic. I was just really trying to.
Oh.
Well done. So I was surprised. Love the song Don't Panic. I think it's a great opening track. I was surprised that there's no mention of any connection to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
It you seems stole like, my joke. Oh my gosh.
But it is a great introduction, so to speak, for the band, for the album. A slower acoustic thing that kind of builds, you know, as you go through the track. But not the first single. This one was released as the fourth single. Is that right? Mm-hmm. After Yellow and Trouble and Shiver? Yeah.
I like it too, the way, like you said, it starts out acoustically and they start with the F, I think it's an F major. I think it's an F major seventh chord. So it's a little bit dissonant at the mm-hmm. beginning.
Yep.
So it doesn't start pop right away. You know, it's not immediately right. a pop song and kind of has a little bit of edge to it. And then they have that, you know, when it breaks in the middle, the instrumental part has that kind of phasing.
Yes. Thing. Yeah.
So that's so really cool how it changes up. And it's only for a little bit. It's only for like a few bars and they just go right back to the acoustic. And I think
very
it's
very atmospheric floating yeah. guitar sound in there that I really, really like. Excellent. All right. Next song is Shiver. And by the way, any other connections, any other pieces of trivia, throw them in as we go through this on any sure. songs, or even if they have a personal connection. Shiver, another song that was released as a single. And a good track. This one, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly not going to make this like a review of track by track. But as far as the four singles, I think it's the least single likely.
So I look in your direction, but you pay me no attention to you. I know you don't listen to me, cause you say,
like, you hear it, I hear it and I don't hear single immediately like I do with Yellow and with Don't Panic and Trouble.
I think this maybe strikes a chord with people. I mean, in my head, I nicknamed this like Chris Martin's Lovelorn song. It sounds to me like faintly desperate. He said he wrote it. I remember him saying he wrote it on a glum day in which he thought, you know, he's never going to find the right girl for him type of thing. So it did have that very personal connection to, you know, from his songwriting to the listener. And then Johnny Buckland puts that descending guitar line in there and, you know, is this my final chance of getting you? Oh, no. And this is kind of like this. And that strikes a chord with a lot of people who maybe are, you know, have an unrequited love or something. And maybe that's why it became, you know, a hit, even though it is a kind of odd song, mm-hmm. is because it struck with people. It resonated with them. And the vocals, again, do that Jeff Buckley thing, which is really, I think, a really appealing way that Chris Martin sings. And that's another way that this song appeals. So,
right.
Yeah.
I actually, in my notes, I actually wrote down this sounds like a mixtape breakup song.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Definitely. The next one is Spies.
I said, how do you live as a fugitive down here where I cannot see so clear? I said, what do I know? Show me the right way to go.
And the spies. And other than the song itself, I don't know a whole lot about the genesis of this. There's some songs that you get some good background from online when you do some searching around. Spies is one of those that is just out there on the surface. What you hear is as much information as you're going to get about it.
I actually heard it was the band kind of wanted to make it their ode to James Bond, like 007 James Bond movies. Okay. Yeah. And for me personally, this is actually one of my favorites on the album. So
Oh, good.
To me, it's like a really visual song. When I just hear him singing the lyrics, I picture, you know, secret agents in scuba suits, and they're underground, and they're going through these tunnels, and everything's covered in seaweed, and, you know, in the middle of it all is Chris Martin sitting in a, you know, a damp tunnel somewhere singing about love again. But it's just, to me, it's a really visual kind of song, and it does have that kind of James Bond mystery feel about it. The introduction to the song has an immediate sense of mystery, mm-hmm. you know?
So. This is my favorite song on the album.
Oh,
I love love the musical effects that they use to add atmosphere. I immediately thought of Thunderball, the women swimming in the water, James Bond theme.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've used that appearance on multiple James Bond openings, but they did have that for Thunderball.
That's what I kept envisioning, was this would be a James Bond theme song. This is better than Skyfall as far as a theme song for James Bond goes.
Oh, wow.
Wow, bold words there.
Yeah, hot takes. Hot takes from Hammond.
There goes all Coldplay. Of our Adele fans. They just hung up their subscriptions all in the moss.
Well, and the end of this too carries through with what Hammond said, where it's really, you know, it kind of hangs at the end. It's got those just drawn out vocal notes, you know, that they're just spies, and it just kind of floats away. And I think the whole song is so cohesive in how it sticks to its own theme. So that's part of what I like about it too.
Is there any surprise from any of us that Coldplay hasn't been tapped to do a James Bond theme? It seems like they would be a very good choice.
Yes.
Would it have been more likely in the mid 2000s, kind of at their first peak of popularity, or do we think that, you know, there's still potential that they could sweep in and do one later on?
I think they could still do one. Yeah, I think they still are relevant
enough that they could, for sure.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know what style they do now, because they've tried so many different things over the past three or four albums. I don't know what they would aim at as far as...
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be very bombastic.
Yeah.
pulling in some horns.
That would be Bond basket. Bastic.
Oh, Bond-tastic. Wait.
It is hard to say. Moving on from Spies, we have Sparks. Alphabetically, right before Spies, but, you know, who listens to an album alphabetically? This is, a much more down-tempo acoustic ballad. What are your connections to this, or what are your thoughts on this one?
I know what you say, oh. But I promise you this.
Actually, this to me is kind of a genius move for as far as track order, because if you listen to the way this song starts, the guitar literally note by note climbs out of the previous song. I mean, it ascends upward. So I think that's kind of cool that the other song kind of drops off and they're still kind of underwater, and then those notes pick up and it goes right up into the next song. This to me, he's asking for like a second chance, but he's aware of his fallibility in the lyrics. It's, you know, did I drive you away? You know, and then later he's like, my heart is yours, I won't let you down. And then he says, oh, yes, I will. So it's kind of like, you know, he's saying, please take me back, but I might just, you know, mess this whole thing up again. So that's kind of, it's an interesting topic for a song, just to sing about sing a romantic ballad that way, I thought was kind of cool.
It certainly is a different take on the traditional love song tropes. Something that I noticed in a lot of these is that even when they're being minor key, you know, even when their songs are predominantly minor keys, it still is a very positive, they still have kind of a positive sound to them. Is it like a hopefulness that's rising out of the melancholy? Is that?
I think it's exactly what it is. I think you just nailed it perfectly, because I think the way they craft the melodies on top of all those minor chords, and you have to admit Coldplay use a ton of minor chords in their songs, that it still carries, you know, an effervescence and like a hopefulness on top, even when you've got all those, you know, you've got, you know, A minor right into an F major ninth right into whatever. Right. And they're all just these kind of like drony, really sharp sounding chords. But on top, he puts those melodies and they float on top. And it's really a great way to construct the songs. So, I agree.
Cool. Anything else on this one, Hammond, before we jump into the one you knew?
all I can say is this actually was not my favorite song on the album. This was, it kind of didn't go well with me, but I can say that it was relaxing and it felt like I was floating in water. It's something you could be floating in the ocean on your back, looking at the stars, kind of listening to this. And so there was that, but it definitely was not something that I would go back and listen to multiple times.
There's something about Johnny Buckland's guitar that does have that floating on water feel, even in other songs besides mm-hmm. Sparks, I think. We mentioned it, you know, with Spies, kind of the underwater kind of feeling, but there mm-hmm. there is a very liquid kind of feeling in the way that it's not really a slide, but
it's very fluid. So it is right fluid. Along with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like he goes from note to note without, there's not a lot of choppiness and everything kind of, yeah, I don't know how to explain it either, but it does kind of like, it's fluid, it goes together properly. It's very edge-like, you know, in the guitar work.
And
as
you
well,
nailed so. Something that it's not very, there is very little staccato music on this album. It's mm-hmm. all really overlapping, dovetailing notes. There's really nothing choppy about anything on this album.
Right. Yeah, which is funny because that's what I think of when I think of The Edge, but I do see the connection you make with the sound of it. A very echoey kind mm-hmm. of...
It's a very wet mix that he uses. I mean, and I'm not being funny. He really does, mm-hmm. you know, use a pretty wet mix on his stuff to give a lot of effect to it.
And that's kind of like the two sides of The Edge, too, because The Edge will play those really, like you guys were saying, the really choppy, mm-hmm. aggressive notes. And then he does those really chimey, almost like the Birds guitar mm-hmm. work, like that kind of sound, that real chimey, where the notes overlap each other and ring out as one note's ending, the other note's ringing out. And yeah, so I agree with sure. that as well.
Excellent. All right, let's get to the song that was released as the first single. And for a lot of people, the first connection that they had with the band Coldplay was hearing the song Yellow.
Yep, I knew this one.
Look at the stars, look how they shine for you. And everything you do, yeah, they were all yellow.
Go Hammond.
That's right. Yeah, I think even people who are not familiar with any other Coldplay work, and I'd be surprised if there's people who aren't familiar with anything else.
And I knew it was Coldplay, because as Brian and I have mentioned in the past, there are times where I think just an era, a decade, pooped out a song, and I don't know who did it. This, I actually knew it was Coldplay, so that's good for them.
This, you bring up a good point. I think that this represents a lot of the feeling of 2000 for me, mm-hmm. the slow build into the really big, really big sound, and then kind of the drop off for the vocals, and then the build up again in the sound. It's a very optimistic, a very happy song in a time where so much of the pop was, we were starting to get into that horrible pop music time with, the dancey stuff that just started to bleed one into the other, mm-hmm. the late 90s stuff.
This is actually
the Hadaways and the Come On Ride the Train and, you know, a lot of that stuff.
This is really good post grungy kind of pop, where mm-hmm. there's definitely grunge influences, but there's a lot of pop influences that color it and make it more than just post grunge.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some discordant sound going on there with the guitar when it cuts into those heavier breaks.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing too with this one is like Brian was saying, anyone watching like any music video channel in the early 2000s, you can immediately you hear the first ringing opening chords of the song, and you immediately picture slow motion Chris Martin walking down the rainy beach in Dorset. And it's just a song. You can't be cynical about this song. The song was actually inspired by, they were at the recording studio in Wales. They were on a break from recording the song. And he literally went outside for a break and looked up at the stars, and that inspired the song. The interesting part for me was everyone wants to know what yellow means, right?
Right.
Now, as a songwriter, a lot of times when you're writing a song, if you don't have the complete idea for the song filled out yet in your mind and you're working on the lyrics, you just put a placeholder word in there, just something to fill. You take the correct amount of syllables and you just plop the word in there to fill it in till you decide what you want to actually put in there for the long term of the song.
Kind of like,
and
that's what happened. Scrambled eggs.
I was going to say, exactly. Like Cordy, exactly. The Mushroom Head used Cordy for their song.
Cordy?
Uh-huh.
And that's what happened with this, is he put yellow in there. And then later he said he kept trying and trying to change it to something else, you know, with two syllables, and nothing else worked. So we just left it in there. And then later the band said, well, it could refer to instead of a person or an inanimate object or a thing, it could be a mood. It's like brightness, it's hope, it's devotion. That's what the yellow ended up representing. But in the beginning, it was just a placeholder word for a songwriter. I thought that was really cool that they actually just left it in there because it worked and then kind of let it develop into its own thing.
It makes such perfect sense because it fits. It's a very, mm-hmm. it's a very happy sunshine feeling song. And I can't imagine any other word in place of the word yellow and having it be as on the nose.
Exactly. Especially not now after the song's been, you know, it's a staple for so many people. So.
Right. And what would you have done with the background behind you when you're in in Skype here? If we weren't going to be listening to Yellow today. This was a great single, a great lead off single for them to get their breakthrough with, because it's so representative of the rest of the album. There's so many examples of this we've talked about in the past on the show where the lead off single isn't at all what the rest of the band's music sounds like. And people are surprised when they get the album and, oh, wow, everything doesn't sound like Breakfast at Tiffany's or you know.
And I think that sinks a lot of bands too. When you go in with an expectation, you're drawn in, you're mesmerized by this band's first single, and you go in and everything is just completely left field and not what you expect. And that's kind of honestly a bad choice that may have ruined a lot of bands. Who knows? So it was good that this really fit in with the theme and the feel, you know, and the ambiance of the entire album. It was a very good choice, I think. I agree.
And frankly, Deep Blue Something can go right to hell for that too, by the way.
Oh, dear.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I think we've uncovered a...
Hit a nerve there, Hammond?
A little... Not a fan of Deep Blue Something?
Not after... I loved her.
I guess you bought the album.
I did. I went out and bought the album and I Breakfast at Tiffany's and that was it.
Columbia House wouldn't take it back.
Nope.
Hammond's note: there's no more Breakfast at Tiffany's on this album. I don't want it anymore. Right.
So right after Yellow, we've got the second half of the album. If you're listening to this on vinyl, I guess this would be the beginning of side two. Trouble is the opening track for the second half, and another. I think this was the second single. Oh no, third single.
Third single.
Yellow was the. Let's see here. So it was released as the album's third single, but it said that Trouble failed to chart in the United States. Music press deemed it as almost as successful as its predecessor, Yellow. So was Yellow not released as the first single from the album? I thought it was.
No, I believe it was as well. Trouble was a third single from Parachutes, and it had a remix of Yellow with it. But Yellow and Shiver were initially released in 2000.
Okay, and Shiver was released as the lead single in the UK.
Okay.
Yellow was the lead single in the US. Okay, that makes sense. Oh, you can leave that in, Hammond. I found that fascinating. Trouble. Back to Trouble. Again, a song with a very... somber message, but delivered in a very upbeat style.
I mean, I adore this. I love the anchoring piano melody of this. It's so simple. It's just a few repeated notes at the beginning, but it's so pretty and it's so elegant. And then, like you said, he contrasts it with these lyrics about confusion and failure. And so you're listening to this, you know, really kind of dainty piano melody. And then all of a sudden he's talking about metaphors of spider webs tangling. And it's such a good contrast. It's such a good construction of a song. And the song's actually about inner turmoil, not of a relationship, a romantic one, but among the bandmates. I guess they were having some trouble around the time he was writing the song. So it's more about, he said it's more about like kind of treating your friends, you know, not not terribly well. So maybe there's a bit of turmoil in the band that's really early in their career. So maybe they were just going through some stuff as they were working on the album. And I guess that's what I've heard the song is about. So that's interesting, I think.
Glad they got past it. And that's Chris Martin is the pianist as well, right?
Yes.
And okay.
Although their drummer, Will Champion, also comes up from behind and plays piano and organ sometimes.
That's cool.
Yeah, he's multi-talented. So
So
multi-instrumentalist. Go ahead, Hannah.
So with this, all of their stuff, I feel like could be used in soundtracks. I mean, there's not one album one song on here that wouldn't easily fit into a soundtrack of almost any kind of film. Sure. The one inspiration that you guys missed when you were talking, and it's really evident in this one, is Pink Floyd.
Oh, wow.
There is so much Floyd, in particular in this song, but all throughout the album. But this one sounds like it was Comfortably Numb, just kind of turned into Coldplay's version of it. There's so much Comfortably Numb going on in this one.
Oh, wow. I had never made the connection before, but I can kind of hear that.
And
interesting.
It was almost distracting how much Pink Floyd was in this song, but I really liked it because of it, because it was such a tip of a hat to a much deeper root than some of these other places you guys were talking about, which are fully credible. But this was a really deep, I think, a deep nod to them, because it had the structure and the feel of a classic Floyd song.
I've actually read a couple of books about Coldplay, and I don't remember reading anything about them being influenced by Pink Floyd. They cite Travis a lot.
See, and that's
crazy. They cite Echo and the Bunnymen a lot, and Muse.
Okay.
So, I mean, but that's interesting. That doesn't mean they didn't, I mean, they didn't pull from it, but I've never heard that comparison.
I just feel like this one just screams Floyd.
Huh. Okay. Yeah.
Cool. And I can hear that. I can especially hear the connection to Comfortably Numb. This seems like it would fit on a...
told you.
on a mixtape, you know, one right after the other, or somebody could easily do a mashup between the two and have it very, feeling very connected to it. Cool. And this was, surprising that it didn't chart in the U.S. because I definitely remember hearing it. So it definitely got some radio play, but maybe it did just after the band started to get big and they'd go back and start playing some of the deeper cuts that were big in the U.K. and maybe not so big out here.
Yeah, I think actually the Coldplay were a lot slower to break in the U.S. than they were in the U.K. Mm-hmm. So it took a little while for them to catch on and for people to start digging further into the album tracks, you know, instead of just the singles that were popping up. So
right. Next up is the title track, Parachutes, and stormy haze,
I'll be round, I'll be loving you always, always. Here I am and I take my time, here I am and I wait in line always.
It almost, you know, does Coldplay go to like antique stores and just name their songs after things they see? Clocks and then parachutes. And over there is a scientist. Well, okay, maybe not so much the scientist, but no, it's. I'm pulling up the song here because I need to refresh my memory on how it goes. Oh, yeah.
It's
awesome. Yeah.
It's only 46 seconds long, which, I mean, on one hand, it leaves you wanting more of the song because it just kind of abruptly trails off and then goes into the next song, High Speed. But I find it interesting that they just kind of plopped this on, you know, toward the beginning of the second half of the album. It's like they just kind of walked in on Chris Martin while he was strumming and singing something and recorded it and then wandered away. It's almost, it's really kind of like, you know, an unhatched egg, so to speak.
It's
kind of sitting there.
The attachment of Parachutes to High Speed does not seem accidental, though.
No, it doesn't at all. It's almost like an introduction to High Speed. Yeah, I agree.
And High Speed, track 8 on the album, feels like a different, I mean, it definitely feels different from the songs we knew, Yellow and Trouble and Don't Panic. It's a very, this almost kind of gave an idea of where the band was going to be going in.
It's interesting you say that. Yes, because this to me has hints of Speed of Sound, the song from their album X and Y.
Can anybody fly? Will my head explode? Will my head stop?
This almost, you know, and I'm granted, it's not just a title and title correlation, but a lot of the instrumental parts of it to me sound a lot like maybe he was inspired by his own past song to put a little bit of this in a Speed of Sound.
Interesting.
So, yeah, and then to me, the vocal is also very Tom Yorkian in spots in this one, the kind of mumbling lower tones toward the end there, the Radiohead sound effects right at the very end of the track as well. So
this would have been the song that if it were released as a single, may have given people a different idea of the rest of the album.
That's true.
Not as drastic as some we've talked about, but I won't mention Deep Blue Something.
One of the things about this song that kind of drove me nuts is I kept waiting for it to pick up tempo. I kept waiting for it to go into a double time. I kept waiting for it to do something other than stay at high the same speed. Tempo. Yeah, I expected it to
you're
do something.
You're ready for it to go high speed is what you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, like about 3/4 of the way in, I was expecting them to kind of start breaking into like a time and a half kind of time signature or something just to vary it up there at the end, and it never happened. And it was a little frustrating because I kept waiting actually, for it to do something.
I wonder if that's actually on purpose, because if you listen to the lyrics of the song is about taking a relationship outside of that initial glowing beginning period of the relationship. And it's kind of saying how, okay, we've been in this relationship, you know, for however long, a few months, and now we're going to take it out into the real world and see how it exists. And it says confidence in you, confidence in me, confidence in high speed, you know, kind of like we can do this, even if it seems all kind of wibbly wobbly and weird and unstable, we're going to go out and do this. And maybe that's why he never put that musical resolve in there, is because he wanted to leave it hanging. He wanted to say, this is where this is going, but we don't know where yet. So you're going to have to wait, Hammond, to find out where it goes.
And that's fine. And overall, I would love it if they did something a little bit more up-tempo on occasion and mixed it up. The similarities of tempos throughout the album was a little bit, I don't want to say monotonous, because it wasn't monotonous. It was just, I wanted some variety, a little bit more variety mm-hmm. in it, in mm-hmm. what they were picking, setting their metronome at. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I mean, it was fine. But like I said, we wish that they would take me a little bit on. I don't need the thrill seeking roller coaster of tempos. I just need it to go up and down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And you feel sure. like it didn't do that from track
not,
to track.
Not,
is what you're saying?
Not as yeah. not as much as I would had thought they would.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, and I can kind of see what you mean. It's they've got a pair of dotted lines. You know, parallel dotted lines, and they kind of stay for the most part between those. I mm-hmm. think that they're a little bit wider probably than like the Violent Femmes or Cake, mm-hmm. things like that, where good solid music, love both of those bands, but those dotted lines are pretty close together and they don't veer outside of those very yes. often.
Well, like the Ramones even. The Ramones have a narrow lane they travel.
Oh, Ramones are a great example. Yes. Yeah. A very narrow
pair and I don't, of dotted lines. It's not that I don't like the Ramones, but I can't listen to 3 full albums of the Ramones in a full sitting unless I'm doing it for a show.
you feel like you do when you listen to 1 full album yes. of the Ramones. You feel like you've yeah. listened to 3 full
yeah.
albums.
And I mean, Coldplay does do what you're saying on later albums. I think they really do really vary in tempo on the same album. So I see what you're saying. I think maybe this is just their first one. They kind of, yeah. oh. maybe it was a comfort zone for them. Who knows?
Yeah. Right. And I'm not,
yeah, caution thing.
And I'm
yeah.
not knocking them for it. I mean, they had an album get released and they've been successful. What have I done? Not much. So I'm not knocking them for it, but at the same time, as a listener, it'd be nice if it's just like with anything, like it's with Slayer and Slipknot, too much. I'd like to have a variation.
Well, come on, Hammond. They released a 45-second song and a 5-minute song on the same album. Come on, what kind of variety do you want?
But they both had the same meter or the time signature.
They do. They do. But there is that through line too of the vocals, even the content, the message of the vocals. I think that the next song, We Never Change, feels like a continuation mm-hmm. of High Speed as far as that relationship. They're as you described, taking the relationship outside, seeing what happens with it. And then We Never Change is kind of like the, are we almost in a rut kind of thing? Like, are we, you know,
I kind of took it as the opposite, actually. I feel like it's...
Did you?
Yeah, because I mean, I almost feel like he's saying life suddenly got too complicated. And, you know, the lyric says, I want to live in a wooden house. It's like a simple plea from a simple man. And again, they're throwing in those minor chords. So it's, again, that use of minors to create emotion. And the minors keep the song from being too simplistic. But if you listen to it, it's really the lyrics are really super simple. It's almost nursery rhyme-like in the simplicity. So yeah, maybe it is about that relationship. That's an interesting way to look at mm-hmm. it. I always thought it was a separate topic, but it might be a continuation of that prior song as well.
So, yeah, well, interesting. And much more prominent guitars in that song too.
The, oh, definitely.
That mm-hmm. again, that same very fluid sounding guitar work that I really do like in this. Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a math equation for this one. It's Pink Floyd plus Dave Matthews no. equals this song.
Come down and live my life. Have friends around. We never changed.
Wait, what was that? Let me hear the first part again.
Pink Floyd plus Dave Matthews equals this song. And it's not a bad thing, but it's.
I think it's so interesting to me, Hammond, that you haven't listened to a lot of Coldplay because your comparisons are ones I've not heard before about this band. So no, I'm seriously, like, I think it's really interesting that you're coming from. I know Brian's listened before and has this album, so you're coming from a completely different angle, and it's neat to hear how you guys are each talking about it completely differently. Because Brian, having heard it,
well, and Brian's then right, and I'm wrong. I get it.
You what? I'm sorry.
Brian's right, and I'm wrong. I get it.
No,
not at all. I just think it's neat that you're hearing. That's what music is, though. You're supposed to, you know, each song, even coming from a songwriter's point of view, everyone that hears your song is not going to get the same thing out of your song, which is kind of what you want. You have your own meaning for the song. That's what you put out there in the world. You know, Brian's going to hear one thing out of it. Ham's going to hear something else. You know, Fred down the street's going to hear something completely different from all of us. And that's the beauty of the whole thing, I think, which is, so that's why it's cool to hear so many different thoughts on these songs. It's very cool.
Very, very few cases is somebody's opinion on a song going to be wrong. Only if that opinion is that Phil Collins actually watched a guy die and didn't do anything about it and then wrote a song about it. It's the only time that somebody's opinion is absolutely 100% wrong about a song. All right, now we get to, you can't really call it the closing track on the album because we get a little bit of a
almost
bonus.
Closing track, yeah.
Almost closing track. On paper, the closing track, Everything's Not Lost. And everything's not lost. Feels like almost a bookend, maybe not to Don't Panic, but more of a bookend to Shiver. If Don't Panic is kind of this preamble, this feels maybe not lyrically, but tonally like a partner to Shiver.
Right, with the piano and the minors and the sevens. Yeah. Did you guys almost hear like a gospel tone in this one? Because that's what I get out of it too. A little gospel feel.
In the melody
and the way the chords interact with the melody.
Yeah, I actually thought of like a slowed down Southern Baptist kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yep, exactly.
I didn't pick up on that at all. That's great.
Yeah. And it's very hopeful. I mean, but it's hopeful in like a subtle way, not an aggressive, like pushy, you know, way kind of thing, but it's just like we all need hope in these dark times type of thing. And I like that. I like that they chose that to be the last, next to last, as Brian said, the next to last track on the album. So there's always hope. 2000 or 2017, it doesn't matter. You know, we always all need that. So I like that.
And then that does get us to like the kind of the bonus track, the hidden track. If you go about 5.5 minutes into Everything's Not Lost, you get the secret hidden song, another short song, about a minute and a half long. It just aches when I think of the things that I shouldn't have done. But life is for living, we all know. And I don't want to live it alone. And it's, this feels like a folk song, like that got kind of a folk song feel. This is a live recording, right? This is something that was recorded maybe on a different, either live or a different tracking system.
Yeah,
what am
sure.
I trying to say here? Help me out.
Well, I don't know if it was recorded along with this. I'm trying to look. I don't know if it was recorded along with the rest of the album or not, but it's almost like a reprise, you know, of some of the themes that were running through the rest of the album. So I'm not sure if it was recorded at the same time or not. I'm trying to look here.
Well, while she's doing that, I can say that as far as definitions of hidden tracks go, this is the perfect hidden track. Some people put songs on there that are dumb and just kind of there. Other times artists hide some of the best stuff, like on secret tracks. This is the perfect one. It's a good one. And it stands out as a, hey, look, there's a hidden track. But it's not a spotlight stealer from other things. Like Todd Snyder is talking Seattle Grunge Blues.
Right.
Why he put that as a secret track boggles my mind because it's the best song on the album.
It is the best song on the album. Yeah. You're a Trash Girl by Cracker is one that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because this one, they also don't do the thing that it seemed like everybody was doing when they did a bonus track that was kind of tied into the last track, which was put 2 or 3 minutes of silence so that you were kind of surprised mm-hmm. when the next track came on if you forgot to turn off the CD player. This comes in seconds mm-hmm. after the end of Everything's Not Lost, and it's tonally not a very different song. Well, not tonally. It's not a stark difference between that and Everything's Not Lost, which I think makes it almost feel like you're saying like a reprise. It's reprise, isn't it?
Reprise, I think.
I'm going to trust the person. I'm going to trust the musician. I'm going to trust the songwriter. To know.
It's not that they threw in a hidden polka track or something. You know, this fits.
Right. Yes.
Although a hidden polka track would, hey Coldplay, if you're listening, hidden polka.
It's
track.
Interesting too that with less people buying CDs now. This whole thing where, you know, a song ends and then you're, you know, in the kitchen getting a coffee and you suddenly get a hidden track. That doesn't really happen with streaming stuff. No. It just doesn't function the same way. So it's kind of cool. It's almost like an old school thing. And granted, the album's 17 years old. So yes, but.
Right. It's called Life is for Living. Mm-hmm. I think a good way, like you said, a good way to do a bonus track where it just kind of grows out of the end of the previous track.
Agreed.
Excellent. What's our takeaway on this? Like, Hammett, are you going to go out and listen to some more Coldplay after this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be purchasing, maybe not the entire album, but I will be purchasing songs to keep on my phone or in my collection. Yeah.
Cool.
Which songs? I want to know.
probably, definitely Spies, awesome. Yellow, and maybe the We Never Change, because it'd stand out because it really was Pink Floyd and Dave Matthews getting together and making a song.
Cool.
I feel like they're going to hear this review and they're going to say, Pink Floyd, we never listen to any Pink Floyd. I don't know where he gets this.
Who is this Floyd fella and why is he pink?
Exactly. I'm sure they've never heard of it. Yes. I've had the album, probably did get it early 2000s, maybe not right away, but after hearing Yellow and Trouble, I think I picked it up saying, all right, is the rest of it this good? And it was, I was happily, satisfied with the rest of the album. And
Brian, do you have any other Coldplay albums?
I do. I've got I've got A Rush of Blood to the Head, A Cold Rush of Blood to the Head. I mean, I want to put a word cold in there, don't I? And I've got X and Y. I haven't picked up Milo Xylato. Oh, I have Viva La Vida too.
It's different. Milo is very different. Viva La Vida is another one that is, I think everyone, if you're going to just pick a couple, that's one you should pick up. And A Head Full of Dreams is interesting because, again, after Milo, it's, you know, that's what, 4 years after Milo. And it picks up with that whole electronica thing again. And they do really interesting things with it. I think they started off with that Radiohead influence and then just kind of ended up doing their old, you know, their own thing with a lot of. There's some like kind of four on the floor beats and club stuff and slowed down, you know, kind of dance floor beats. And it's interesting. It's an interesting, different change up. But again, those melodies and the positivity and the hope is what runs through so much of Coldplay's music, which is a really big reason why I think it's great music.
Yeah. Yeah. Picked up on a lot of their stuff. Their later stuff that I wasn't as familiar with, obviously through hearing covers. So, there's a great cover of, what was it? Is it When I Ruled the World, or is that just called Viva La Vida?
Viva La Vida.
A great version of that, an acoustic version of that song by Lady Gaga, where it's just her and the piano, and you really hear the talent that she's got when she doesn't have a lot of
meat on her face,
arrangement, and I wasn't gonna say the meat, but yeah, the production and all that stuff at it. She's really, really talented, and it you forget that, you don't hear that, or you're not reminded of that when you hear the more dancey tracks. But in that version, she's really, really good.
Have you ever done a Coverville of
Coldplay? I certainly have. What episode? I'll tell you the episode number. So 615 was the first Coldplay cover story that I did back in 2009 that actually features that Viva La Vida by Lady Gaga. And then on 1162, I did a two-parter that was half John Bon Jovi, who was turning 55, and Chris Martin, who was turning 40, and then did the two of them as one episode.
Oh, that's cool. Coldplay actually have a lot of kind of odd single tracks that they've done for various things. If you dig some of those up, even Hammond, I think you would like some of the more obscure stuff that they do, just because it's so different and maybe draws on different influences, and maybe that would be stuff you would enjoy as well. A lot of just like kind of acoustic stuff and covers of stuff that they've done. And yeah, just, there's a lot of interesting stuff to dig around in their back catalog. So
I want to be clear. I like these guys. You don't need to. I'm not trying to downplay any of this. I did like it. It's just that I wish that they had been a little less relaxed.
So a little more dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's my only real negative thing to say. The lyrics are awesome. The production is great. The way they use different effects and the way they use different mixing and mastering techniques to make the music dynamic and interesting that way. Huge thumbs up for that. But I just wish they'd been a little bit more awake. Because
it is a more mellow album.
Yeah, it's a very relaxing album. This is one of those ones you put on as you're falling to sleep. And the words, you pay attention to the words as you fall asleep, and it takes you places. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's one of those, it's really good that way. But I'd be afraid to drive to this. I'd be afraid to drive to this.
No road trip Coldplay parachutes for you.
Well, Hammond, you should listen to Viva La Vida, and you should listen to Milo, and let me know what you think of those.
Okay.
I'd be interested to hear.
I have homework.
Yeah, sure.
I had to look up because I could have sworn that they'd done a cover of a James Bond song, and I'm pretty sure I played it on a show. They do You Only Live Twice. They did for Glastonbury in 2000. Oh, and cool. I couldn't remember if I was thinking of it because Radiohead has done Nobody Does It Better. Mm-hmm. And I want to say Travis did one as well.
They covered Goldfinger, didn't they?
They covered Nobody Does It Better also. So both Radiohead and Travis did Nobody Does It Better, and Coldplay did You Only Live Twice.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, I had to throw covers in here somehow.
Of course.
Completely unplanned. But
by the way, I'll just say this. Dream Theater. Okay, we're good.
we've covered all the bases. Very good. Well, Christy, it's been an absolute delight having you on here and kind of helping set the stage for what future episodes of this show might look like. Tell people where they can find you.
Well, thank you guys, first of all, for having me. I really am honored. It's such a great show, and I'm very happy to be on it. And I like talking to both you guys, so thank you so much. You can find my stuff. It's pretty easy. ChristyKates.com, which is KristiKates. I only spell it because it always gets spelled incorrectly. Twitter is a great place to see what I'm doing. I'm very, very current on Twitter, which is just twitter.com/ChristyKates. And then I have a new music performance show that I've started on Twitch about 6 weeks in now, which is twitch.tv/ChristyKates. That's 8 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday nights, and it's live performance of music. I do my own original songs and covers as well, and it's great fun. We have a really super awesome active chat. I play some requests now and then, and we have a really good time. So I hope some of you guys will join me over there as well. Thank you again, you guys, for having me on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. So on behalf of Christy and Hammond, this is Brian Abbott saying that is going to do it for this episode of Soundography. We'll see you next time right here.
Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.